Welcome to the third lecture in the semester series sponsored by CAPE. We have a special treat for you today. You will get a discussion of some objects that I have seen since 1966 without explanation, and finally I will get an explanation of what I've been seeing on display in Riley Robb. I have a quiz question for you. What's on your list of the most significant engineering triumphs of our era? I'll take that to be the last century. I'll put a plug in for May 19 lecture on whales, elephants, and wilderness. So come back for that. The National Academy of Engineering published a book at the turn of the century called A Century of Innovation, 20 Engineering Achievements That Transformed Our Lives. It was a serious effort. It had a foreword by Neil Armstrong and an afterword by Arthur Clarke. And so I ask, what would be on your list of the 20 most significant achievements in engineering? So let me show you what the National Academy came up with. Electrification came as number one, as transformative of the world. But you will notice that number seven is agricultural mechanization. And perhaps you didn't think about that. Sadly, I will say my colleagues in Riley Robb probably didn't think about it either, and they would probably flunk this test. But it is even higher than number 13, the internet, for which we had a lecture back in February. So it has been transformative in the view of the premier group of engineers in this nation and is of consequence in our lives. Jerry Recugler, our speaker, has made some significant contributions to agricultural mechanization himself. His first two degrees were from Cornell, and then his PhD was from Iowa State. Jerry studied with Wes Buechele, and if you've driven across the countryside anywhere in this country, you will see these big bales about this tall. Wes Buechele, his advisor, invented the device that created those bales, and it has just spread rapidly everywhere. His special interests are engineering of biological systems, and especially agricultural power and machinery, which is a buzzword for our profession at that time, food engineering, off-road vehicle dynamics, product harvesting, digital imaging for quality and defects, in particular studying apples. His employment history is rather simple and straightforward. He's been Cornell red and white for his entire career, and he marched up the chain of command here. He was department chair, and then moved to Associate Dean for the College of Engineering, and since 95 has had an emeritus status. The project you're going to hear about is something he's done as an emeritus professor. He's a fellow in American Society of Agricultural Engineers, founding fellow in the American Institute for Medical and Biological Engineering. He has four ASAE paper awards. Those are our miniature Nobel Prizes in the profession, three patents, a registered professional engineer, and at the bottom it lists some of the topics that he's spent his time working on. His spouse is a United Methodist minister, and he is a serious, and I mean serious, when we were scheduling this talk was scheduled to come after the snow season at Great Peak, so he is a serious skier still. So the topic is one that has had a long and storied history. I was amazed to learn that Thomas Jefferson had designed a moldboard plow, and if you go to Monticello, you'll see an exhibit of his plow. It also has a special place in Cornell history. Earl A. White did the first PhD in our field in 1917 on studying the moldboard plow. So it's, and if you want to see that thesis, it's at that address. But it has been a persistent interest, and it goes back thousands of years, and we are at a particularly important turning point in the history of the plow. But we will now hear about the Rau model plow collection at Cornell and the evolution of plow designs.
Thank you for this nice introduction, Bob. I was reading about humility this morning in my devotional, and I think I should say that I'm humbled by being able to have this opportunity to talk to you about an activity that I've been involved in for quite some time now, and it's become my joy to be at the office from every day that I'm not on the ski slope. And to bring a emphasis on the ski slope, I did get in 94 days on the ski slopes today, or this year, and that's a little bit above my average of 75. Let me give you an overview of what I'm going to talk about. Introduction, and I'll talk a little bit about the origin of the models, plows. I'll talk about the Cornell collection connection and the storage and display. The Rau model plows documentation, which we put together. And the evolution of the tillage and plow design, which I'll illustrate with Rau plow models. And then we'll have a discussion and conclusions, and hopefully there will be some more time for questions. The plows originated in the Royal Agricultural College at Hohenheim. They had a shop there where they started developing models for use by the students and for placing in the German culture to illustrate agricultural success or agricultural applications. And they started in 1819 and went through 1909. And it's in the era of about the 1860s when the model plows were proliferated. There was a number of them. They were constructed at the behest of Professor Ludwig Rau, who was a professor there at the Royal Agricultural College, and a master craftsman was engaged to carry it out. If you had a chance to look at the plows on display, you'll see how beautifully they are, beautifully put together they are. They're very meticulous and well done by the master craftsman there. There was 187 models made in the collection at one time, and those 187 models were made in the 1860s, were displayed at the Paris Exhibition of 1867. That's when they were first displayed, 187 models at the Paris Exhibition. They represent the development of the plow from about 3000 BC to the 1860s. Obviously, 1860s being the time when they were constructed. That were produced for the exhibition. There was also private models produced as well for private collections. And probably in the world today, there are some individuals who have private collections of these model plows and other apparatus that we had that they produced at this location. And right now, there's a German agricultural museum in Hohenheim where there are about 500 of these models on display at that agricultural museum. And I had some conversations with the curator, Frank Emmerich, who is associate curator at that museum, who just says that they are now on display and obviously preserved from the work of the craftsmen at that time. There's also a number of them on display at the German Historical Museum of Berlin. Now, in 1868, A.D. White was on his way across Europe and overseas to collect materials and get some insight as to how education took place in Europe. And so in his 1868 European tour, he ended up in Hohenheim at the Royal Agricultural College, looking at the materials that were at that point, at that location. And in a letter of May 21st, 1968, he wrote to, Whites wrote to Ezra Cornell the following.
Went to the Royal Agricultural College of Hohenheim, grounds of the palace and the multitude of buildings for the various departments, significant workshop where agricultural machines made as samples, workshop where models of machinery were also made. Among others, a complete collection of models of plows used in all nations and times, 187 in number. They were on small scale, 1/8 the size, I think, but perfectly made, that every bolt and screw and every cord was exactly given. From the rudest plow in Bible times and earlier to the English hard plow, American improved plows, all important makes, categories, and given. Some are exceedingly curious and form wonderful examples of applied ingenuity. But altogether, they are very interesting and instructive. They are the result of the studies of Professor Brau of Hohenheim and the mechanical skills of the master mechanic of the college. If anyone had told me a year or two ago that I could ever be interested in a collection of plows and horseshoes, I would have laughed heartily at the idea, but I have rarely seen anything of late more interesting. I thought that was a very interesting insight as to the relationship with Andrew White and Ezra Cornell and what was going on.
I got your quote. Okay. They were purchased. A.D. White stepped out and said, I'm going to purchase them regardless of what Ezra might say. And he got in a carriage and went over to Wurttemberg and ordered up these collection of model plows. And he got them for 2,000 francs. And he was somewhat happy about getting them for 2,000 francs because the French had bought them for 2,500 francs. And he thought he'd driven a pretty good bargain. And he did say to Ezra that if you don't like them, I'll take them off your hands. So I hopefully Ezra liked them. Well, they were shipped to Ithaca, obviously, and the storage for them was unknown. So they came in 1868, maybe they got there by 1869, and nobody really knew what was going on. However, about 1873, there was $1,000 was allocated for a agricultural museum. And at the same time, I.P. Roberts was hired as an assistant professor. So somewhere along the way, I.P. Roberts got together with it, and there was $1,000 available, and they began the construction of or providing a place for an agricultural museum. And it turned out that this agricultural museum would be at the second floor of Morrill Hall. And there's verification of this in an 1876 report to the Senate. Cornell apparently reported to the Senate of the state of New York in that period of time. And they say there was a museum at Morrill Hall. And then further in the 1899 to 1890 register of the Cornell, the publication called the Register of Cornell, they also mentioned the second floor museum of Morrill Hall. So we have some idea that what happened at that period of time. In 1906, we have some documentation from the oral history from Professor Riley, Howard W. Riley of Riley Robb Hall, who was hired to set up a rural engineering department. Apparently had some association with the model plows, and whether they were in Roberts Hall or Stone Hall or whatever, they were someplace in that location. I think it was Roberts Hall where they were located at that time. So the collection was there, and Riley remembers that that collection. At that time, Professor Stone was working with Riley. And Professor Stone would go out to make exhibits and at the fairs, and he took those model plows out to the fairs to hopefully to bring attention to plowing and so forth. However, in the process, the numbers of 887 models began to diminish, and Riley even mentions that for some reason or other. Obviously, you go out and make a display, there's always a potential of breakage or loss or whatever, but they did disappear. I'm not sure exactly where those plows were held up until 1956, but at that time, Riley Rob Hall was completed, and the plows were moved to Riley Rob Hall. At one time, they were displayed at Mann Library. Anybody here remember seeing them and displaying at Mann Library? They were illustrated. Good, at least yes, Bud. Thank you. And then we also had them in Riley Rob Hall, obviously, and stored there. And we did have a display in Riley Rob Hall. The display in Riley Rob Hall went through some phases. First, at one time, we had a display in the lower basement hallways in plastic in display cabinets, and they were all mounted and displayed in a very nice fashion. And I was involved, actually I started, got involved with this whole process back as far as 1960 in a peripheral way, because Clayton Van Hout, our mechanic there in the department, took upon himself to set up the display and make little mounting stands, and I helped with getting the display labels, and so we got a display down the hallways to show the development of the plow. And that continued actually through to the present, and most recently, in the last few years ago, we had about 26 of them on display in a locked glass cabinet in the Riley Rob lobby of the Riley Rob Hall. When I got involved with this process in 2009, it looked like we ought to really do something about this. It's part of this, Barry Adams has mentioned it, and Frank Moon, obviously, are working on other artifacts across the university, as well as others. Maritai got involved in doing something about these collections. And so I started in 2009 inventorying and restoring the models. Unfortunately, during the interim, the models had been sort of put into a locked metal cabinet, fortunately, but they were dusty, they were dirty, they were some of them were in pieces and so forth. And so when I got through the process of rehabbing, we have about 123 complete models, and I have parts for three or four others and some others I can't identify. So that's the attrition that has taken place of those 187 models. The good news from my point of view is that there are 500 models that are in preserved in the Agricultural Museum in Hohenheim, and so we have a cross-reference as to what we have and what they have there. So 123 complete models, and I have already mentioned the rehabbing efforts. I had to very delicately clean off the dust off of all of them, and if you looked at the models on display there, you can see how intricate they are. I had to get a little brush to clean them up. I felt like a curator at a museum when I got into that. Then I decided we were working on actually a photographic record. So we have a photographic record of all the models that we currently have. And then it was a matter of looking at the documentation that relates to these plows. In 1881, there's a directory put together by Professor Rao. It has a 317 plow models that are in this directory that are described, their origin and so forth. And it was a fairly lean directory that was put together. Subsequent to that, there was also an elaborate classification scheme which was based on the design. And then there is an annotated version of that directory that I got from the Smithsonian Museum, or I didn't get it from the Smithsonian, I don't know who got it from there, actually. In 1952, via the Smithsonian, there was a Mr., let me see if I can find my reference on the name of the person there. Well, I don't have it here at the moment, but there was a person at that location in the Smithsonian who had stored material from the 1867 Paris Exposition. And so those documents actually are still on file in the Smithsonian. But they provided us with an annotated directory that shows the reference material from which that was used to produce the models. I proceeded to with the process of translating from German to English. And as I was talking with Alan Renwick the other day, I studied German quite a few years ago during my PhD. And I tell you, I struggled with getting the translation. I'm not sure it's very good, but there is a translation available. And here it is. We will put it online and make it available. And Ari van Tienhoven was very helpful in having some notes on some of the translation and interpretations. So we do have a translation, and both the directory and the classification scheme. Just to point out that I think the German expression is "alles ist Ordnung," everything is in order. And the German character is to create a very orderly, well, I got to go back, haven't I? Here we go. A orderly classification scheme. So you go to the directory, you'll find there were groups, major groups from A to I, classifications from 1 to 25, and subclasses from A to U. So you have all that structure that's there, and it's kind of interesting to follow, because if you sit in the office like I do at time, look at the plows on display on my shelves, I can visualize why they came up with this scheme. Okay. And there is modern documentation. There is a book by Ernst Klein that was published in 1967, which has 454 photos and descriptions of these plows. And I was, when I talked with the curator at the Hohenheim Agricultural Museum, he said, "Well, you can get this book from an antique dealer." And I said, "Well, you know, I'm going to go to the library and look up in the library catalog." Lo and behold, Cornell has this book. And 454 pages of German, and I've just ordered a book for how to read German easily. So, as an emeritus, I think I will be occupied for several years now on the translation. The interesting about this book is that there have been different people have written documentation and use different numbers for the plows. So they're cross-reference. So I can cross-reference what is in the Rao directory with current directories. And so it's going to be an interesting little puzzle to put together to see what goes on. Okay, well, let's get on to the evolution of tillage and plow design from 3000 BC to the present. And it'll relate to the design changes that take place, and we'll have a few anecdotes about what is going on relative to the evolution of plow design. This is taken from a hieroglyph from a tomb in Egypt, which illustrates the Egyptian plow of 1700 BCE, before the Common Era. The plow originated likely in Mesopotamia in around 5000 BC, and maybe also in the era of the Egyptian dynasties, and maybe 3000 to 1700 BCE. This plow illustration right here is somewhat inaccurate, because the oxen do not move by long by themselves. Typically, you will find it takes oxen, a driver, and a plowman along with the oxen. And if you, in the Bible, and when Elijah gives his cloak to Elisha, they're plowmen in the field, and they illustrate that there are multiple plowmen as well as the drivers of the oxen. So two per set of oxen, two people. And in this case, you say, well, how is that, well, I got to point to it here this way. How is this pulling taking place? And if you look right here, this beam goes up this way. Well, it actually goes up and cross. There's a cross piece typically put across the horns of the oxen and provides the way to pull. So they did not use a yoke at that time. So that was the way that they were pulling. Very simple plow with a simple point, and used it probably in the Nile Delta where there was not much vegetation. Now, these are illustrations that you out on our display. You'll see the plow from Italy, plow number one from the Rao model plow collection. It came from Italy around 500 BCE. It's just a simple, simple pulling beam with a hook shape to till the soil. And in the early development of our country, the pioneers did not have access to steel and materials, and they would often go out into the forest and find a tree which had a limb and at a particular angle to the trunk, and they would carve out their plows of this kind, even in the 1700s, and 16 and 1700s in our country. The plow began to develop. This is an ancient plow from Greece. And as you can imagine, there needs to be some stabilization to keep the plow point in the soil. This plow point, and then they would add a handle to provide the plowman with an opportunity to hold that and stabilize the plow. Then further developments, in addition to the handle, of course, if you had a wooden point, you could probably harden it by putting it into the fire and harden it, but it also would wear off, and so began to apply metal points to the plow and to improve its life, not having to go out and cut another tree down again and make another plow. The sophistication began to grow. This is a Moroccan plow, which is somewhat similar to the Egyptian plow. Again, these are all models from the Rao plow collection. And there is reference material that backs up how these were developed. Again, this is a pulling beam, and you can see the cross piece here, which would go on the oxen's horns. The plow point right here, a metal point, and a connection to the handle in this fashion. Somewhat weak connection, I would say, probably subject to some failure. Here we have a plow from India, which is a modification of that similar hook design. And so you could say in the model collection, there are a whole host of hook designs that were put together. This is the an improvement on the ancient Egyptian plow. Originally, you can see the triangular brace placed in this fashion, some metal pieces that were put here. And this kind of plow could be used as late as the late 1800s in Egypt. Then further development came along. In the Nile Delta, the soil basically very little vegetation because of the overflooding and the silting. And so a simple plow with a hook could crisscross and till the soil for the planting. However, when you got to the more temperate climates, you had vegetation, and you had some need to deal with the vegetation. And here is a Swiss plow, which is a further development, with, again, the plowshare for penetration, some near to a plow sole here, which means a horizontal to the plow surface. And this is a knife coulter for cutting through any vegetation that might be on the surface so you could spread the soil apart. And obviously a handle for holding, and then the pulling beam here for whatever animal power that was being used. This Abyssinian plow is fairly simple, similar to that we just looked at. It was used in Russia. And again, the triangular brace and the, well, more as a horizontal plow sole. And I might point out that I hadn't mentioned before that the plow collection represents plows from all over the world. It just covers the whole spectrum of the world. I'm fascinated. I haven't done the research yet on all of this, but I'm fascinated by how all of this has been authenticated, because these plows have very specific designs, and I'm still curious as to how whoever put this together has actually authenticated these particular designs. Well, continuing, here's a Russian plow, and again, you can see the plow design is beginning to change somewhat, and this is from the Caucasus region of Russia. And again, a knife colder for cutting through the vegetation, a metal point here, and now a plow sole, which is horizontal to the soil, which is more conventional, to say, for what we see today, with the handle rising from the plow sole. And this is Demeter's plow, the Greek goddess of agriculture, is from Greece, and again, a similar plow of design that's in Greece versus Russia versus other parts of the world. So the inventors, I don't know whether they actually communicated with each other or not, but I'm suspecting that great minds move into the same channel, and it's very well that inventors across the world had similar ideas and put them into practice. And of course, the bracing here obviously makes this a stronger connection. Now, as time evolved, it wasn't just simply enough to crisscross the land to make provide for tillage of the soil and a seed bed. There was some desire to invert the soil slice, or at least push the soil from one side to another. And so it began to develop what we would call a primitive moldboard. And there are all kinds of variations on this primitive moldboard. I learned what Uhren means in German. I mean ears. And spigots, I learned about spigots, because in some cases they would put ears out here, or they would put spigots, there's little poles out to the one side to push the soil across. And then here is a more sophisticated approach where these round bars are attached to the plow sole and allow to pushing the soil from one side to another, starting, of course, with the plowshare cutting into the soil. Now, that development continued, and eventually we began to develop a precursor to the modern moldboard plows. And in this case, we have pretty much some of the elements of a modern plow. That is, we have the plowshare. Whoops, gotta go back. We have the plowshare, the knife coulter. This is now a moldboard. It's just a simple board. And underneath this, which you cannot see, is the plow sole, which rides along the soil surface after you've cut through. In India, they developed something a little more sophisticated. It's hard in this illustration to see, but this is a spiral-shaped moldboard carved out of wood, a metal point, and a carved spiral-shaped moldboard. And here's a very beginnings of a way of inverting the soil slice and plowing, essentially plowing down whatever is on the surface of the plow. This is the French Arvelin's plow, which is a metal moldboard. And you could say this probably has almost all the elements, and this would be in the 1850-1860 era, and you can see it essentially has almost all the elements of the modern plow, with a knife colder, a plowshare, moldboard, landside over here, and a plow sole underneath. So you have all the elements of the modern plow. Now, for specialized situations, they developed various kinds of specialized plows. This is the Latvian hook, and you might say, well, this is very similar to the tine plows of today. If any of you are familiar with what is happening in tillage today, tine tillage or minimum tillage is common. You might say this is a minimum tillage tool of the 1700s, but this is the Latvian hook. You have two penetrating tines here, a divider for dividing the soil here, and I would presume it was pulled by one animal. Then there's the other variations. Someone asked me as they were looking at the display, why this one? Well, the wheel plows was a method of providing greater stability in operating the plow, and so that was a design variation that took place. And here again, we have the plowshare, the moldboard, but in this case, twin moldboards is just simply dividing the furrow as you travel through the field. And there are other kinds of unique inventions. If you've ever done any plowing, you would know that you have to, if with a plow that throws the soil in one direction and inverts the soil, you have to go around the land and come around and go in a loop around things to throw the soil, and it throws away from it, and you end up with what is called a dead furrow in the middle. Okay? Well, this is not necessarily an advantage, and then also there's idle time going around at the end of the field. So some of the inventors came up with bidirectional plows. In this case, this is a German bidirectional plow. You plow, you pull with this direction when you're going through the field, and then when you turn around, go back to in the opposite direction, you plow from this end. So you just flip the plow around and do that. And there are multiple designs of that kind in the collection showing other variations of way of doing this. Some of you have seen, if you looked at the collection, a model that flips over, the turnover, the rotating one. Okay, I should not miss out on mentioning the first, the Chinese contribution. Actually, the Chinese had iron moldboards in the first century BCE. Amazing. And Europe did not. In the 3rd century BCE, they actually had metal shares third century BCE. And this was, their developments were unknown until the 10th century in the West, in Europe. These Chinese designs, I think probably was the explorations of the Dutch and their whatever they did. They brought Chinese designs to Holland in the 1600s, and the Dutch were amazed by the interesting development. Let's talk for a moment about the modernization phase of the plow design, which I find quite interesting. The mathematics and design were looked at by Jefferson and White. There are three parts of the modernization phase. One is the mathematics and the design. The second one is interchangeable parts. And the third is improved materials, following Oliver and Deere. And let's just take them one at a time. President Jefferson was quite interested in the plow, and in the 1700s, he developed a mathematical model of the moldboard of least resistance. And he was quite taken with the process of reducing the draft required to pull a plow, and he came up with a model for the moldboard, which was a moldboard of least resistance, as he defined it. In 1917, as Bob has already mentioned, White produced a study of the plow bottom and its action on the furrow slice. That was a first PhD thesis, I think, in agricultural engineering, as far as we can tell. Interestingly, Riley poo-pooed the work that was done by White. He didn't think much of it, which was an interesting. Riley was a very practical engineer, I guess, and he didn't think much of the work that White did, but it certainly set the stage for subsequent studies of that. Let's take a moment here to talk a little bit about what happened in the United States in terms of plow development. In 1797 was the first patent on a cast iron plow. Subsequent to that, there was the Weird plow, which is another cast iron plow. And then eventually, Deere and and Wood came along and made further developments. But most of this was all related to the walking plow. And you can see here the design of the walking plow with the pulling beam, the plow share here, the mow board, and again, the plow sole and land side, which you cannot see. So those developments continued. And then there was the early tractor plow, which is simply connecting with a simple pulling point with wheels supporting the early tractor plow, and multiple bottoms, typically with disc holders in this case for separating the soil. And this is now a decorative item at a friend's place in South Carolina. And that's typically where they end up nowadays. And then finally, the modern plow, which is illustrated here. And if you look at this plow bottom design, it's very similar to the late 19th century plow bottoms. And the only thing that's happened is people have been more sophisticated about the design of the surface. So let me conclude, and then we'll have adequate time for questions. It's a long history of development, 5,000 years. The models are, the plow models illustrate the design change. Crop culture and food production will continue to require tillage of some kind. However, minimum tillage seems to be the future. And so I end with opportunity for questions.